The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
Now, it's been a week where both the conflict in the Middle East and the war in Ukraine offered both horror as attacks continue and hope as there's more talk of ceasefires and talks about talks in both conflicts. To make sense of what may be happening and to talk about the role that US President Trump wants to play, we're joined now by Scott Lucas, Professor and Political Analyst at the Clinton Institute at UCD. Scott, good morning and welcome.
Very good morning to you, Pat.
Now, it's interesting that Ukraine is back in the news after President Zelensky wrote that open letter to President Putin, who instantly dismissed it. But it did have an effect.
Oh, I think it had an effect in terms of it exposed how rattled the Kremlin is. Because just before this St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, which is one of the showpieces of the year for the Kremlin, Ukraine had carried out strikes on the St. Petersburg oil terminal, damaging it, and on a nearby naval facility, badly damaging a warship. So Putin was supposed to use this talk on Friday to talk about how they're doing so well, even though they're not, in this 51-month full-scale invasion of Ukraine, to talk about how the stories of the Russian economy are doing poorly, are wrong, and Ukraine had actually exposed that not only is it resisting the Ukrainian attacks, it's moving from resistance to a bit of strength. But at the same time, Pat, I think it's important to emphasize that Zelensky's letter, because he knew that Putin would not accept face-to-face talks, was to seize the diplomatic initiative. Because he's playing back to an audience, including the United States, saying, look, Russia's not serious about ending this invasion. You know, you need to continue to give us support against what is basically Russia's ongoing effort to conquer us.
Yeah, Trump must know this. He must be told by his people, even though they are sycophants and they may be scared of telling him the truth. But if they tell him that Putin is on the losing side at the moment in Ukraine, Trump doesn't like to be supporting losers. He's now appears to be bored with the whole Ukraine thing.
That's absolutely right, Pat, in that what you had before this escalation of Ukrainian attacks this year was that there were certain people in the Trump camp who supported the Kremlin's aims. Notably amongst them was the envoy, the real estate developer Steve Witkoff, and the worry amongst Ukraine and its defenders, especially amongst Europe, is that when it got to the negotiating table, the Americans would effectively tell Ukraine, that's it. You've got to give up more territory. You've got to keep the rest of the country weak. What has happened now is, as you've described, it's quite right, is that the Americans have just said, oh, that's it. We're walking out. Not just Trump saying this, but Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, saying, well, it doesn't look like we're making any progress. I think that actually clears the space for Ukraine and Europe now to say, look, you know, if the Americans are on the sidelines, we continue to take the initiative here militarily and diplomatically. As long as the Americans don't oppose us, as long as they don't come in and support the Russians, then this gives us the space to continue to put more pressure on Moscow.
Now, let's move on to the Iran war. And, you know, we're making great progress, is the latest diktat from President Trump. The Iranians are less optimistic about a settlement. So the question is anything really happening? Are they edging towards a settlement? And, you know, will the Iranians actually provide an off-ramp for Trump to save his face?
You know, I think the easiest way to cut through both the fog of war and the fog of diplomacy, Pat, is to walk this back 2 weeks, which is that we had kind of reached a stalemate in the military side of the war, in that the American attacks and the Israeli attacks could not force the Iranians to surrender, that the Iranians had gotten leverage with this vital waterway, the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. imposes a blockade on Iranian ports. But almost 2 weeks ago, Trump and his officials are close to accepting the Iranian terms for a settlement. And what the Iranians had did, I think quite skillfully, is said, look, we will discuss arrangements for the Strait of Hormuz and agree them, as well as a lasting ceasefire in return for the lifting of sanctions and unfreezing some of our assets. And then in the second stage, we'll discuss our nuclear program. So they had taken the initiative, and just as the Americans were thinking they might sign it, Trump received a lot of criticism in Washington from those who either want to continue the war or thought he was selling out to Tehran. So he backed away from that. And that's where we've been for the past 2 weeks, is that Trump wants a deal. He needs a deal because of domestic pressure and pressure from the Gulf states, but he doesn't want the deal that's on the table.
Now, he'll have his allies in Fox interpreting the deal as a brilliant deal for Trump, even though it probably will be no better and perhaps significantly worse than the deal that Obama cut.
Well, I'd compare it, first of all, Pat, to where we were on February 26th, and that was 2 days before the Trump folks decided to join Israel in the war on Iran. At that point, the Strait of Hormuz was open. You know, the Iranians didn't control it. There were not, you know, 1,500 ships that were there could have moved out easily. The Iranians were discussing limits on their nuclear program, as you mentioned, that go back to 2015 and the agreement that they struck with the Obama administration and other countries. There was the possibility they might have to discuss their ballistic missiles, their ties with groups in the Middle East, such as Hezbollah. And the Trump folks threw that away. They threw away their leverage in the negotiations by going into a war that ultimately did not succeed. And as you quite rightly mentioned, the deal that's on the table, and it's easy to see where it lands, is that the Iranians take this 60% enriched uranium and say, okay, we're not going to enrich it further to military grade. We'll reduce it to 20% or even 3.67%, which was the limit in 2015. But why can't Trump accept that? Because it's got Barack Obama's name on the deal.
Now, the question of Netanyahu's role in all of this, I mean, the bombardment of southern Lebanon and indeed Beirut itself. I watched a very interesting report from ITV showing the destruction in parts of the center of Beirut, apartment blocks being deliberately targeted and rendering an area that had been occupied by a million people uninhabitable at the moment. It's certainly dangerous to live there. 95% or thereabouts of the people have actually left. So Netanyahu continues apace, effectively trying to annex parts of Lebanon, even though Trump allegedly called him effing crazy.
Well, this is, in effect, what Israel gets. I won't say as a consolation. It gets this as a maneuver if there is a U.S.-Iran ceasefire, and that is the Israelis don't get regime change in Tehran. The regime survives there, but Israel does get an expansion of its space, of its occupation, if you will. We have seen this in Gaza. Indeed, remember that the Gaza occupation, which was fixed at 53% in the deal last autumn, it's now 60% occupied by Israel, and Netanyahu wants 70%. Well, the same thing's happening in Lebanon. Not quite on the same scale, but the Israelis already occupy an area up to what they call the yellow line, 10 kilometers inside Lebanon. And they could extend that up to 30 kilometers inside Lebanon with the military operations that are still going on, despite a supposed extension of the ceasefire between the Israeli and Lebanese governments last week.
Now, the question is, will Netanyahu's unilateral actions put the kibosh on any deal? And that's a big question, because he does seem to have the president's ear. And certain things happen after Netanyahu talks to President Trump, which may not happen when others talk to him. So is Netanyahu the problem now in reaching a settlement?
Israelis are certainly a factor, but I don't think it necessarily works that it's always that the Israelis twist Trump. In fact, I think what the play here is by the Iranians is to try to get it the other way around. Remember in 2025, Pat, what ended the 12-day Israeli war was an Iranian maneuver with the Americans. They got Trump to call Netanyahu and say, that's it, Bibi, you got to stop. And we saw this almost happen last week in that Trump got extremely worried that he can't get an Iran deal because of these Israeli attacks on Lebanon. And then he had that conversation that you quoted from, which was very, very bitter. But what has happened at this point is we're in a kind of a limbo, Pat, because we still don't have a U.S.-Iran ceasefire. Trump and the Americans have said to the Israelis, okay, we don't want you attacking Beirut. So there haven't been that many attacks on Beirut in recent days. But the Israelis still have a relatively free hand in southern Lebanon.
Let's move to domestic politics now. And he's had a number of setbacks. He's his slush fund, it appears, is certainly in abeyance, if not, in fact, scrapped by the man who wants to be his permanent Attorney General, Todd Blanche. The name has got to come off the Trump and Kennedy Center. And there are a number of votes in the House that have not gone his way. I mean, is the romance between Trump and MAGA faltering?
Well, we need to separate two fronts here. The reason why his name has to come off of the Kennedy Center is because of a legal case that said, look, now you know you're not authorized to stick your name up on there, even if you fired all the board and packed them with your loyalist. I think the more serious attempts that show the Republicans are getting jittery because we're only 5 months away from the elections have to do with the criticism of the slush fund. This almost $1.8 billion that Trump effectively has rushed through via the Justice Department could go to his friends, could go to his donors. It can go to people who are involved in the January 6th attacks. Then what you also have is questions about his expenditure on this ballroom, which is now apparently a ballroom and a military bunker. And you had some pushback on the Iran war, where both the houses of Congress have now passed a resolution saying they want to have a role in authorizing further operations. I don't think it's the level yet where Trump is boxed in on many fronts, especially since much of what he does is through executive orders. But it does show that the Republicans are starting to think, now you can't just give him a free pass on everything because we could get hammered at the polls in November, given what is very let's call it that the whiff of corruption now is a bit of a stench, to be honest with you, Pat.
What is going to be the final bit of overreach? I mean, the slush fund, it appears, was overreached by Trump. The naming of the Kennedy Center after himself, all his vainglorious attempts to memorialize himself in life with the arch and the ballroom and all of that. I mean, are people becoming jaded with him? And as you say, the stench of corruption, the family making billions of dollars through the presidency and then doing a deal that gives them immunity from tax audits. I mean, is that what's finally going to do for him like it did for Al Capone? It's tax man.
Nah, I wish, Pat. Sorry to tip off my partiality here, you know, but I think Trump is actually shielded now because of his personal attorneys who head up the Justice Department and who have struck this deal where he can no longer be, well, not struck, they imposed this arrangement where he can not be audited or investigated in perpetuity. I think what happens more broadly politically is sort of his demise by a thousand cuts. And that is that the fundamental in the United States is still the economy. And with the economy not doing well, with inflation going up, especially with gasoline prices going up, given what's happened with the war in Iran, with the labor market in poor shape, with consumer confidence at its lowest point in history, or at least since we measured it, I think what you get are Republicans who will not defy him on one single big piece of legislation or one single big vote, but they'll have signals, as they have done in the past few weeks, on smaller pieces or smaller steps that have taken place that says, look, we need to protect our political future, and our political future is no longer protected by being part of the Trumpism.
I'll read you one comment that's come in about the coverage of Russia and Ukraine. Russia is not losing, for goodness sake. How is it losing after growing its military to almost 2 million? How is it looking when real wages have grown? How is it losing when every day they are gaining ground? How is it losing when BRICS has grown to more than the G7? I half live in Russia, Crimea actually, and everything you keep pushing is pure disinformation.
Let's just put the facts out there for not just that listener, but for others. And that is that Russia lost territory in Ukraine. In April and in May, it's the first loss of territory it's had in Ukraine since 2023. It has not made a significant advance on the front lines this year. in the east or in the south. Meanwhile, you have Ukraine's counterattacks, which have struck oil facilities, which have struck ports, which have struck terminals, which have struck electronics facilities, chemical plants, and have struck Russian military positions. On top of that, the Russian economy has actually declined. It recorded a minus 0.2% loss in GDP in the first quarter of this year. That's the first loss it's had since 2023. It has now imposed gasoline rationing in parts of the country. Its oil revenues were down by half earlier this year. They've gotten a bit of a pass because of U.S. sanctions waivers, but if those sanctions were reimposed, they're in trouble on that front as well.
And losing, whether to death or serious injury, over 30,000 troops a month. How long can that be sustained? Although I was told yesterday by an expert in these matters that only 1 in 10 of those on the front line is actually Russian. The rest are effectively mercenaries recruited from all over the place for very good money, it has to be said. Scott Lucas, professor and political analyst at the Clinton Institute in UCD, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.